It's The Takeaway for August 13th. I'm Tanzina Vega. Demonstrations in Hong Kong show no signs of letting up.
Now there's just sort of almost desperation of looking for new and creative ways to make a statement and to say that we are not going to give up.
The latest on the protests in Hong Kong and the parallels with Tiananmen Square. Also on the show, in light of the calls to boycott Equinox and SoulCycle, what does it take for you to quit a brand?
When a company or a store hurts people, then I do not patronize them.
It is by far and away the most effective and efficient way to facilitate change.
My comfort is much less valuable than my morality.
All right, everyone, let's get started. Police violently clashed with protesters at the Hong Kong airport today. Democracy demonstrators have occupied the airport for 5 days, halting hundreds of flights as demonstrations against the Chinese government press on. Until now, the airport protests had been largely peaceful. But that ended today. Police moved in close to midnight local time, scuffling with protesters, and there have been reports of pepper spray being used against the demonstrators. The clashes are just the latest sign of escalating tensions between protesters and Hong Kong law enforcement, and there are growing concerns that the Hong Kong government is being pressured by officials in Beijing to take more drastic measures. In recent months, protesters in Hong Kong have demonstrated against an extradition bill that opponents say encroaches on their democratic system. Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, said she would indefinitely suspend the bill in June, but she has not withdrawn the bill, and the protests have only grown. Rosalind Adams is a world correspondent for BuzzFeed News, and she's been covering the protests from Hong Kong, and she joined us from the airport.
Basically, what I saw was I came back into Terminal 1. Some police officers who were not riot police were in the airport. They said that they were there to assist somebody who had gotten hurt. I'm unclear about the details of that, but definitely it riled the crowd up to see the police, and there were chants of "give back her eye," which is a reference to the woman who lost her eye on Sunday from a beanbag bullet. From there, some of the protesters followed the police outside. A few of them were attacking a car that had police in it, throwing water bottles, kicking it. It was enough damage that I could see a dent in the car. And then from there, riot police did show up. I'm not exactly sure what spurred it, if it was the car, but certainly they were being blocked. A number of riot police came in. Protesters immediately built a barricade at the entrance of the airport. So I don't think the riot police actually got inside the airport. I was outside, sort of in the middle of the scene. They had built a barricade right outside. Police did spray pepper spray. I saw one man getting first aid for the injuries. And I saw police forcefully arrest somebody. And then from there, police did retreat. But tensions are pretty high right now. The protesters are actually holding a man zip-tied right now that they believe is undercover from mainland China. So there's sort of a mob scene going on. People are concerned about police showing up again. And it's just pretty tense here right now.
Rosalind, just to be clear, were there any travelers in the airport? It's pretty late over there. Had flights resumed, or was this pretty much an empty airport with just protesters and the police?
You know, there are definitely more travelers here today. This standoff definitely happened more towards at the entrance, so I'm not sure where. I think there are some travelers here. They may have retreated somewhere. The mob scene that's happening right now in Terminal 1 is certainly all protesters. But I've seen travelers here all day. I know that some people are waiting for overnight flights, but to be honest, I'm not sure where they are now. They may have retreated. There was a huge sort of scene of screaming at the police once they entered the airport.
We know Chinese authorities earlier, before these skirmishes with police, had recently labeled the protests as showing, quote, the first signs of terrorism. Is there concern that Beijing authorities and Chinese authorities will start to move in after this?
I think that's the question on everybody's mind. Some people think it's rumors. Some people think it's scare tactics. Really, I think that's the big question. What will be the sort of thing that sets it off or that does cause China to intervene? I think that's a big source of the tension. among protesters on the scenes here with the clashes is wondering if or when that will happen, or if it's just scare tactics to get protesters to retreat and sort of back down, which so far hasn't happened. These protests are really nightly.
And remind us again why the protesters chose to target and sit in at the airport. It's now been 5 days, potentially going on to 6 days.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the airport is a huge symbol of Hong Kong as a commercial and financial hub. It's a way to get international attention. Protesters, you know, I'm well identified in a press vest, and protesters are always eager to sort of pull you aside and explain to you why they're here. I think they see this as a symbol. They see it as a way to get the world to pay attention. And, you know, people are watching. I think, you know, people are flying into Hong Kong from all over the world. And, you know, actually these 5 days have probably really renewed attention in a way that street skirmishes have not, actually.
You know, Rosalind, one of the things that's come up is the use of technology in these protests. I'm wondering, are protesters concerned about covering their faces? Are they concerned about having the police using facial recognition technology to track them down after these protests? Or is that even on anyone's mind at this point?
Yeah, it's definitely on everybody's mind. People do stay covered. There's no evidence that police are using facial recognition technology to make arrests, but it's obviously widely used in the mainland. And I think the other thing is, you know, after the Umbrella Movement, protesters were targeted after the protest culminated. And so I think that is certainly on everybody's mind, that you don't need facial recognition technology if there's enough photos, even, you know, if you start to identify people, if people are publicly saying they're protesting. I think, you know, I think that's certainly on everybody's mind, is protecting their identities, definitely.
Rosalind Adams is a world correspondent for BuzzFeed News. She joined us from the Hong Kong airport as the clashes unfolded. In 1989, mass demonstrations in China challenged Beijing's absolute control of the nation.
There are hundreds of thousands of people here in Tiananmen Square, perhaps as many as 500,000, even more.
As a column of tanks headed out of the square, a lone young man stepped in front of them. The lead tank tried to veer around him, but he sidestepped to remain in its path. The column ground to a halt.
In the history of communist China, there has never been anything like this.
Pro-democracy demonstrations reached a breaking point on June 4th when the Chinese government deployed the military to stamp out the protests, killing thousands in what came to be known as the Tiananmen Square Massacre. Today, experts worry that Beijing may launch a similar crackdown against protesters in Hong Kong. Here to explain some of the historical parallels for us is Orville Schell, the Arthur Ross Director for the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Orville, thanks for being with us on The Takeaway.
Pleasure.
You witnessed the 1989 protests in Beijing. Can you tell us, Orville, how do the Tiananmen Square protests and the demands the protesters made then compare to the protests we're seeing in Hong Kong today?
Well, what's hauntingly familiar is the way, sort of the arc of the demonstrations, the way they gather momentum and keep reinventing themselves in order to keep people engaged. I think your report from the Hong Kong airport reminds me very much of what happened when in May in Beijing in 1989, the students decided to do a hunger strike as a tactic to kind of reinvigorate the protest. And I think it was a very clever tactical move that the students moved to the airport, a highly symbolic place where people come and go, a nerve center of Hong Kong, and also a public space, big lobby of a big airport. So there are lots of ways that we see similar kinds of escalations. And I think the very worrisome part is that each time there is an escalation and each time they gather a new sort of group, a new grievance, a new demand, of course, it becomes more impossible to imagine a resolution short of confrontation.
Orville, when it comes to the Chinese government's response so far, are you seeing similarities in how the government was acting in the lead up to Tiananmen Square?
Well, I think the government at first in Beijing tried to be quite restrained. But it does, of course, consider Hong Kong a sovereign part of China. And really nothing like this, so visible and so public, has happened to China in terms of remonstration since 1989. And yet in Hong Kong, it's a little more difficult for them because they don't control it directly. So they're sort of the hand in the glove of the special administrative region government under Carrie Lam, which isn't to say she has much independence. But it's sort of like having a spastic arm that keeps answering its own will. But ultimately, I think it's undeniable that China will feel so affronted that it will feel compelled to act. And of course, that gets us to the military solution.
Well, let's talk a little bit about let's drill down a little bit in that relationship between Hong Kong and mainland China. Because if this was a situation that were happening in mainland China, as the Tiananmen Square massacre did, that gives China obviously different jurisdiction over what it can do from a military standpoint. We've seen early reports that China is beginning to amass troops nearby, not in Hong Kong itself, but nearby. How does this relationship between Hong Kong and mainland China complicate a potential intervention by the Chinese?
Well, one country, two systems presupposes that Hong Kong has a high degree of autonomy, and one of the elements in that autonomy is its own police force. So for China to come across the border either with the People's Liberation Army or the People's Armed Police, which is a paramilitary group, would be a grievous sort of blow to that notion of one country, two systems. It's sort of astounding when you think about it, because I've been going to Hong Kong since 1961, and it for decades was known as a city without a political bone in its body. It was criticized, so all it wanted to do was to make money. Politics were sort of strained out of everything, except when they spilled over from the mainland. And now we find this city galvanized into the poster child for worldwide political consciousness and protest. It's a pretty stark transformation.
We know it's early to predict, but given everything, particularly the Chinese government saying that there are, quote, signs of terrorism, Orville, is there a possibility that the Chinese government could carry out a similar crackdown in Hong Kong?
I think if you actually look at the way, as I said at the outset, the demonstrations have arced, have fed on themselves, have gained in momentum and gained in militancy, it's very hard to imagine how the Beijing government or the Hong Kong government can step down to answer enough of the heap of demands that is piled up. So it's with a kind of a terrible sense of inevitability that one looks towards a military solution. But then one has to also remember this would be a terrible blow to China. I think China would rather not do this. And then after they send in forces, then they end up with a kind of a potential Battle of Algiers situation where they may have gotten the people off the streets, but they could be in a kind of an urban guerrilla war situation. There's an awful lot of angry and politicized young people in Hong Kong right now.
Orville, right now we're seeing China get into some tumultuous trade scuffles with the U.S. and the U.S. and China. Neither one seems to be backing down here. The Chinese government has also been under scrutiny for its treatment of the Uyghur Muslim population. You kind of alluded to this in our first segment, but can the Chinese government afford to carry out a Tiananmen-style repression on its protesters?
Well, I think it would definitely prefer not to have to do it. But you're absolutely right. The government in Beijing is under tremendous duress, both from the trade war and the situation in Xinjiang, the Uyghur situation. But historically speaking, what's going on in Hong Kong is exactly the kind of affront that the party most abhors. And it tends, when it gets confronted by something like this, to see foreign hands, black hands at work. So already the United States has been blamed. So in a sense, what's happened is that demonstrations in Hong Kong have been almost globalized to make it part of an ideological war of democracy against autocracy, with the United States leading that charge. And there is a notion that strangely was lofted by John Foster Dulles in the 50s called peaceful evolution, which sounds pretty good to someone who doesn't understand Chinese communist doctrine, but the party hates it because what it presumes is that slowly, through Western influence and Western color revolutions, China or other parts of its empire, if you will evolve away from it. And this is a complete affront to the notion of a strong Communist Party unifying the nation, rejuvenating the nation, which is a key part of Xi Jinping's China dream.
Let's talk a little bit about Hong Kong and their law enforcement tactics so far. There have been clashes with protesters that have included tear gas, protesters who've spray painted security cameras, and things have gotten pretty serious. So they seem to have, in some instances, exercised restraint, in other instances, gotten into tussles with the protesters. What can you tell us about that strategy so far?
Well, what's interesting, first of all, about the student strategy is that they seem to be taking a leaf out of Mao Zedong's own works on guerrilla warfare. In other words, don't concentrate the way they did in Tiananmen Square in 1989, namely in the square in one place. But as they say, be like water. Just pop up here, pop up there, disperse, don't have leaders. Don't do anything where there's a central apparatus that could be easily dismantled. And so that has created a very difficult problem for the police force, because you have these pop-up demonstrations now going on all around the city and now out at the airport. This creates, I think, all the more pressure to beef up the Hong Kong police force. Already they've taken the numbered badges off their uniforms so that it's difficult to know who's who. There are rumors flying around the city that already there are Chinese police in the Hong Kong ranks. People have said they've heard Mandarin being spoken, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a tremendous amount of rumors and a tremendous amount of uncertainty as this demonstration, this protest, is sort of broken into a multi-headed hydra, creating a terrible problem for the police in putting it down.
It's also the police. We had a New York Times reporter on just recently talking about the use of technology in these protests and how the police have starting to use facial recognition technology to identify protesters. Protesters, police themselves, as you mentioned, have taken their numbers off their badges. Protesters have hidden cameras and the like and are increasingly hiding their faces. How do you see that evolution of technology compared to what happened in Tiananmen?
Well, of course, there's a whole new technological world there, and this is the heart and soul of the protest movement's ability to coordinate in any way by using things like Telegram and the internet. So we are seeing a whole new technology-driven kind of a protest movement that was unlike Tiananmen Square, that had nothing except radio, television, newspapers, and word of mouth. And thus it had to be more centralized. But this can be dispersed and makes it much more difficult to know how to put down. And if, as I said a moment ago, if in fact they did clear the airport out, and if they did bring in troops or stronger force and occupy the center of the city and stop the protests, they would just be squeezing it out into other parts of the city. And I think they would find themselves still putting out myriad fires every day.
Orville, the United Nations has called for both sides, the protesters and Hong Kong government, to be peaceful in how it resolves their differences here. They've also encouraged Hong Kong to investigate the use of excessive force by law enforcement. If this continues to escalate, including an intervention, possible military intervention by China, at what point could we see international intervention?
Well, I think that's not likely. China is incredibly militant about its sovereign borders, and I think that would be an affront that would just tip the whole apple cart over. And there's really no foreign power, even Britain, has much of a claim to come in. So this is, and I think in this sense, Trump was right, this is a Chinese matter. But that doesn't mean it wouldn't have repercussions around the world and wouldn't affect China's standing, its trade relationship, and indeed its relationship in almost every conceivable way.
Orville Schell is the Arthur Ross Director for the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Orville, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
Politics and business don't always mix. Last week, fitness brands Equinox and SoulCycle saw firsthand what happens when politics comes into conflict with customer loyalty. A major social media backlash erupted soon after reports that Stephen Ross, the chairman of the company that operates the fitness chains, had planned a fundraiser for President Trump's re-election campaign. many customers vowed to take their business elsewhere. And you've been telling us what makes you quit a brand.
I boycott Walmart because of their poor employment practices.
As a gay man, I boycott Chick-fil-A over their anti-LGBT stances and the money they give to anti-trans candidates and causes.
I only boycott companies in instances of blatant moral abuse.
I've been asked by my daughter recently to boycott corporations that have paid into Trump's re-election campaign.
While research suggests that boycotts are unlikely to actually have much of an impact on a company's bottom line, with the rise of Twitter and Facebook, brands still need to toe a very fine line when it comes to weathering the storm of a political controversy. And I'm joined now by two guests to discuss brand boycotts. Americus Reed II is a professor of marketing at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us on The Takeaway, Americus.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tanzina.
Also, we have Karen Doyne, the president of Doyne Strategies, a crisis communications consulting firm. Karen, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tanzina.
Americus, let's start with you. We've seen boycotts on the left and on the right with from brands including Uber and Nike and Chick-fil-A and a ton others. How similar are those boycotts to the situation that's happening today with SoulCycle and Equinox?
Well, I think those boycotts are interesting, Tanzina, because they, I think, have a more direct linkage to a moral transgression. I think in this case, when you're talking about SoulCycle and Equinox, which is owned by or partially owned by this company called The Related Companies, which partially is controlled by Stephen Ross, it's a much more tenuous link, I think. And so I think that there is more degrees of freedom for consumers who want to try to justify staying with the Equinox or the SoulCycle brand to be able to do so, because I think they can construct in their mind a rationalization that says that the financial impact that's going directly to Stephen Ross isn't as great as it might be in those other cases that you mentioned.
Karen, in your work in crisis communications, that you've been doing this for 30 years or more than 30 years, first of all, are brands worried today when these types of boycotts take off on social media? And if so, have they started to change their response in the time that you've been working on this?
I think so. These situations have been a real wake-up call, not only for the companies that are immediately affected by the boycotts, but also by other companies who are watching the situation very carefully and know it could happen to them. They're learning that essentially the ideal time to respond in one of these situations or to come up with a thoughtful response to one of these situations is not when you are looking at 5 million angry tweets and a walkout by your employees. The best way to approach it is to have thought through these issues in advance, come up with some standards and guidelines and messages so that you can both respond quickly and explain why your company is or isn't taking a stand on an issue.
And have you noticed, Karen, that companies are more willing to do that or at least feeling more pressure to be able to respond either in advance or when it happens, given the prevalence of social media, given the fact that a hashtag can, you know, for better or worse, can actually change the conversation?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there are two things that have changed, really. One is certainly that in terms of social media, the ability of audiences to organize and mobilize and get very big spikes of public attention, and also the expectations of companies' audiences and stakeholders, the expectations of their own employees, the expectations of their customers, and they know they have to respond to that. But it's a tough lift for them. It really is.
Americus, I want to bring it back to SoulCycle and Equinox a second here, because they themselves, the brands, are not liberal organizations, if you will, but they do market this sort of lifestyle brand of wellness and I mean, just the name SoulCycle in and of itself. And let's also be clear, these are not inexpensive services that SoulCycle and Equinox. These are premium fitness brands. People are paying a lot of money to go and take these spin classes and access these high-end gyms here. So the clientele is you know, probably better off than your average American here. But does the marketing approach put these brands more at risk when a backlash occurs?
Well, I don't think so. I think these brands are not putting themselves out there as a values-based brand. And so you'll have to dig into that if that's something that, you know, upsets you. I think I want to go back to Karen's point. What's interesting about social media is that it feels very powerful and emotional, but it's also oftentimes a kind of costless morality. In other words, expressing this sort of moral outrage on Twitter is a very different idea than actually canceling your membership and inconveniencing yourself in order to try to express a particularly aligned political ideology that you might find very important for yourself. So I don't think these marketing brands, like in the case of Equinox and SoulCycle, have very much to worry about. I think they just keep their heads down. They come out with a statement and basically validate the concerns, show some action. As Karen is saying, kind of control the narrative early on. But oftentimes the research literature is very clear that these kinds of boycotts often just fizzle out because there just isn't enough energy and momentum to keep them going. And so brands, I think, need to pay attention and do a lot of social listening out there in the ethos in terms of what people are saying about their brands. But the actual idea that a boycott or a movement is going to happen that's going to financially hurt the brand is something that we just don't tend to see in the literature.
Karen, in terms of the actual companies that are doing it well, companies that are maybe not doing this, handling this so well, do you have any examples of a company that really rose above the fray and responded in a way that that resonated with its consumers?
I think Starbucks, in particular, is a company that knows its brand, knows its so-called brand promise, its relationship with its constituencies, whether that's their employees, whether it's customers, whether it's business partners. And they use that as their North Star to respond to situations like this. They've been involved in two interesting ones in recent years, probably more than two, but two in particular. One being the arrest of the two African-American men in their store in Philadelphia. And they acted very thoughtfully and very quickly on that one in terms of apologizing, making things right with the two men who were affected, making a very strong statement, giving a donation to a relevant cause as well. But several years ago was a tougher, even tougher situation for them when they got pulled into the gun control debate. There were open carry gun clubs that were meeting in some Starbucks in open carry states, and they started thanking Starbucks publicly for letting them meet there. And that led to a backlash from the gun control advocates. And Starbucks was caught in the middle. And ultimately, and they took some time to think it through, and ultimately, they took a middle ground approach that spoke to sort of the needs of their stakeholders and also their corporate values. And that was, we're going to allow guns in Starbucks in open carry states because that's the law. And at the same time, they put out a statement saying, we respectfully request that customers at Starbucks do not bring firearms to our stores. That is, we feel that it doesn't mix with the environment that Starbucks wants to create. So there they found a middle ground that most likely was fairly acceptable to both sides of that debate.
Karen Doyne is the president of Doyne Strategies, a crisis communications consulting firm, and Americus Reed II is a professor of marketing at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Kate. I'm calling from Harrisonburg, Virginia. I have and I continue to boycott both companies and any kind of celebrity that exhibit racism, sexism, homophobia, or transphobia. And when I can, I let them know why and that I have. My comfort is much less valuable than my morality.
Hi, my name is Lee, and I'm calling from North Bergen, New Jersey. Yes, I have boycotted brands and companies before for unethical treatment of their employees or because the owners are donors to what I deem hateful political movement.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.